Hello and welcome to the Movie Robcast. This is Rob Daniel with just a little bit of housekeeping before we begin. This review episode of the season finale, Better Call Saul, and Better Call Saul in general, does feature a lot of spoilers for Better Call Saul, and also for Breaking Bad, and also for the finale of The Shield. If you don't want any of those to be spoiled, then we suggest that you check them out before you listen to this episode, and then come back and listen to the episode. If you're okay with all those spoilers, then please enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Robcast. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, I'm joined by my dear friend and co-host and co-conspirator, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it is an absolute pleasure to be here. Am I your paralegal as well?
Yeah, well, you know, both being tried and trying together.
Yes, well, I've often been said, I am very trying.
Well, today we're taking a break from the usual format in what will be an episode of the Movie Rob and TV Cast, in which we're discussing the final episode, the show finale of Better Call Saul.
Yes, hot on the heels of the Neighbours finale, we then had to do the next one about its spiritual cousin, Better Call Saul, is of course the prequel to Breaking Bad.
I can't believe that. I mean, obviously this is the sixth season that has just ended, the sixth and final season. It doesn't feel that long ago that we were watching the first episode, does it? I mean, separately watching the first episode.
Well, not for me it doesn't, because it was 2019 that I watched the first episode of Better Call Saul. So
okay, that's fair.
So, but you've watched this since it started in 2015?
Yeah, I was 25 years old, Jesus.
But then again, you're still horribly young now, so there you go.
And what essentially began as kind of an interesting, slightly unusual, yeah, what would happen if we took the lawyer character, the kind of comedy lawyer, primarily from Breaking Bad, played by Bob Odenkirk, and gave him a prequel, his own show. Well, not just a prequel, as it turns out. Yeah, it's like, okay, this is an interesting step for Vince Gilligan. Breaking Bad expanded universe, okay. And over the course of six seasons, I think we can probably both agree, not to give anything away, it turned into one of the most interesting shows in television.
Yeah, but on that note, I think we're going to have to say we are going to give things away. This kind of has to be a spoiler episode because we're talking about the final episode of Better Call Saul. So, yes, this will have spoilers in it for the series, for Breaking Bad as well. You will also, I think, hear my neighbours in the background outside. But yes, it all adds to the rich tapestry that is this show.
If you haven't watched the final episode of Better Call Saul, watch the final episode of Better Call Saul, Saul Gone. If you haven't watched Better Call Saul, watch Better Call Saul. But before you do that, if you haven't watched Breaking Bad, watch Breaking Bad.
Yes.
So that's like 100-something episodes of TV, so just go away and watch those. And yeah, we'll see you when you get back. Well, we won't see you when you get back.
It's about 110 or something like that, but it's 110 episodes of perfect telly. And it's interesting, even though this is a prequel, you have to watch Breaking Bad first, because as you alluded to, elements of Better Call Saul also take place after Breaking Bad. And that's why I think it works so well. Because to be completely honest, I held off watching this. I actually didn't watch Breaking Bad until the whole thing was there on Netflix. I watched the first three episodes when they went out for the first time on Channel 5. And thought, this is good, I'm not in the mood for this right now. I'm sure it's great, I'm sure I'll catch up with it at some point. It took for the entire thing to complete its run. And then I just watched it over a month. This was Breaking Bad, and thought, yeah, this is just one of the best things I've ever seen.
I did a almost minute-by-minute analysis of every episode of the second half of the final season of Breaking Bad.
Wow, where can we read that?
It's on my old site, of all the film blogs.blogspot.com, which I've just discovered is actually still running. So, yeah, I may have to do something with that at some point.
Well, we'll put that in the show notes, but is that not ported over to your new site of allthefilmsites.com?
No, because I couldn't be bothered to do the formatting because it includes a lot of screenshots.
Oh, okay, yes. And it is very, very difficult to reformat. I have done that before when I tried to change the themes on my blog. Well, yeah, definitely send through the URL for that and we'll put it into the show notes. I'd be interested to look at that myself. And that's the thing, is that these series, I mean, they do stand up to very, very close scrutiny. But with Better Call Saul, it was like, okay, so prequel. And of course, when you say prequel, you immediately think of Star Wars, which of course was just a very, very bad idea. And spin-offs rarely work. I mean, for every Frasier, there's going to be a dozen that just didn't work. So again, I just avoided it. All of my friends were saying, this is so good. It's as good as Breaking Bad. And then in 2019, so before lockdown, I thought, actually, I might give it like an episode. Watched the first episode. It was good enough to get me to the next episode. Good enough to get me to the third episode. And by that point, it was like, yeah, I think this is all I'm going to be doing.
I guess I'm doing this.
Yeah. And this will be my month, because it pretty much was just a month, like Breaking Bad, because there were five seasons. But as I was watching it, I was thinking, I seem to remember that this isn't the end after five seasons, so there is going to be another one to go. And of course, got to the end of the five seasons, and it's like, that, to use the cliche, was like a big, rich novel. So many characters come in and out. It is so well done. The character psychology is so rich, so varied. The characters that aren't in the Breaking Bad series are as good as any character in Breaking Bad, particularly Kim Wexler, played by Rhea Seehorn.
Finally has an Emmy nom.
Yes, indeed, because she hasn't had one before, has she? And it's like, she has never been anything less than brilliant. And there's that scene when... So Michael McKean, and everyone who's listened to this knows all about the series, but Michael McKean, who's brilliant, plays Chuck McGill, who's Jimmy McGill's brother. Jimmy is, of course, Saul Goodman. When he dies in that house fire, and Howard, who is the partner in the law firm, says to Jimmy, well, Chuck killed himself. Do you remember that scene when Kim then has that absolute meltdown at Howard for putting that on Jimmy and for almost using it as an act of revenge against Jimmy, and she just completely explodes at him? Do you remember that work?
Yes, I do.
Because that, I just had to go back and watch that scene again after that episode finished. It's so, she is so brilliant in that. And just watching someone act with that level of fury and it just being absolutely authentic and believable. So that just came as a real surprise to find out that she hadn't had an Emmy nomination up until this final season. That seemed like an oversight, and, oh, she better win.
Yeah, because she's one of those actors who, I mean, she's, I think, been working pretty consistently since the late 90s. And it's been, you know, loads of stuff. But, like, Better Call Saul was kind of her breakout role. And everyone just sort of went, wow, she's incredible.
She really, and that's the thing, because she was in Veep. I mean, she's been in Veep. She was in an episode of The Twilight Zone, the new one. And I just do not remember her from these things. But I'll go back now and we'll be like, oh, wow, it's Kim, forever Kim Wexler from Better Call Saul. So, yeah, she did seem to just emerge.
She now fits into my big map of character actors in the late 2000s, early 2010s, who were, like, in loads of stuff, because she was in Trust Me, she was in Dollhouse, she was in Burn Notice, she was in The Closer. She was in an attempt to remake The Thick of It for the US.
Yeah. And it's so weird, isn't it? It's one of those things where I do like it when you get these actors who've just been working actors and have appeared in things, and you've seen them in episodes, but they were just in a one-off episode. You didn't really remember them. And then they get that role that makes the most of all of their talents and really, really makes them a star. Yeah, because she has worked consistently since 97.
I now inexplicably want to see her do something with Walton Goggins.
Yeah, that makes sense. What would it be?
I don't know. I just feel like they'd have an interesting chemistry.
I just want to see what she does next, because it's like, well, it'll be interesting to see what she goes on to.
Oh, do you know what?
Go on.
In terms of her working with Walton Goggins, they can cast her in the Justified miniseries that they're doing.
Yeah, she would be a good fit for that sort of series, yeah. But it's like, yeah, what is Bob Odenkirk going to do next? Hopefully Nobody 2. So it was one of those things where it's like, okay, so we got to the end of season 5 of Better Call Saul. And it's like, oh, so I'm now going to wait for a year for season 6 in 2019. Of course, 2020 was COVID year. And it's like, oh, we're not going to get that. And then Bob Odenkirk had a heart attack. And it's like, no. One, because always liked Bob Odenkirk. I first came across him when he played Larry Sanders' agent in The Larry Sanders Show, and he's absolutely brilliant. I think he was called Stevie, and he's just such a sleazebag. It's actually like, you could see it as like a forerunner to Saul Goodman. So it was one of those things where it's like, he's always been a great actor and comedian, and it would be such a tragedy if he went so early. And also, really, really selfishly, it's like, but Better Call Saul hasn't finished, and ooh, it would be like, are they going to write a novel instead if he doesn't recover? So yes, it just shows how selfish I can be when...
No, I think you can care about Bob Odenkirk as a human being and genuinely like be like, I hope he's okay for his own sake, the sake of his family, the sake of his friends. And also be like, I also hope he's okay because I love him in that show he's in.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. That's where it's coming from. Yeah, very well put. I'm not a monster. A little bit. But of course, he did make a full recovery. And there is the episode this season that has a scene in it where part of it was filmed before the heart attack and part of it was filmed afterwards. And, well, I couldn't see the join. I think it's the episode where he's organising the robbery of the department store in the big mall that he works in. I did not spot any weird joins in that episode at all.
No, which is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, but also things like... Chuck, so the Michael McKean character, Jimmy's brother, the fact that he has that psychological disorder where he becomes terrified of electricity, and he's this brilliant lawyer, this absolute genius legal mind, who also, of course, is not above constantly belittling his younger brother, but has this illness that he lives with, and that was just done so well. And again, it just showed how you can have people who are, it's not just heroes and villains, there's just so much shading here. So,
well, because that's the thing, because both him and Jimmy in very different ways have this flaw, have this thing that's going to prevent them from practicing the law. In, you know, in Chuck's case, it's his inability to be in the presence of electronic devices.
Mm.
And in with Jimmy, it's a complete lack of a moral compass.
Yeah, they are different flaws, yeah. But you're right,
exactly,
they are both flawed. Do you remember, and again, it's one of those things, because that's, I mean, obviously, anyone who's listening to this is going to say, duh, but so much of this show is imaginatively filmed, as it was with Breaking Bad. Vince Gilligan is someone who just knows how to compose a really, really striking image.
Well, they built up such a house style, didn't they?
Yes, absolutely. And that episode... where I think that Chuck's had a psychotic break and has started wandering the streets and eventually ends up in hospital, obviously surrounded by a load of electric equipment. And the whole thing is filmed upside down, so he's strapped to the gurney, but it looks like he's hanging off of it and that he could fall at any moment and that reality is inverted. That shot was like, again, this just keeps setting the bar high and then just goes above it.
There's a really nice moment in the finale that references Chuck's condition.
Oh, is that the flashback or...?
No, in the present day.
Oh, yes, indeed. When yes, I know what you mean, but go on, you say it.
It's with... and again, we won't have a spoiler section in this. We're just going to talk spoilers. When Jimmy, I think as we're going to probably call him... I'm going to call him in the context of this this episode,
yeah.
Is talking about what he did to Chuck. He's in the courtroom, he's testifying, and he talks about Chuck's condition, and it cuts to, like, a shot... It's shot through the on the exit signs of the courtroom, and you can just hear the electric, like, the neon buzzing.
Yeah, such a great moment. It's such a subtle moment, because it actually took me a moment to get why that was there. It's a great shot because you get the exit sign in the extreme foreground of the frame and it's filmed from an elevated angle, so it's looking down on Jimmy. And it's almost like Chuck is looking down on him at that moment. And there was just so much going on in that scene because, of course, that is the scene where he gets his humanity back and he gets his soul back. It was only actually a few seconds after that that I realised, oh my God, that was this amazing reference to Chuck. Oh, the thought that goes into it.
And yeah, no, who knows, maybe that year delay for COVID, that year and a bit delay, was in the worst possible circumstances for the best in terms of the show, because they certainly, you've got to assume, had time to think about it.
That's a great thought, yeah, because it's like, what would this have looked like? I mean, I'm sure it would have still been brilliant, but they must have taken that time to make sure that they'd got something special and to really think through it all and to see if they were missing any more nuggets of gold anywhere. There's even that bit, so when Jimmy and Kim go to the law firm for Howard's wake.
Hmm.
And Jimmy looks at the bin and says, oh, they've got a new bin, which is the exact same shot setup to a scene in season one when Jimmy looks at the dented bin. I can't remember how it gets dented, but I think he does it.
Is that when he's shut outside?
Yes, I think it is. That's right, yeah. And it's like, well, even that is having a callback. And he says, oh, they got a new bin. And it's like, this is ace. Just the amount of care and attention that is put into even the smaller details is so brilliant. And actually, while we're on the subject of Howard, have to give a shout out to Patrick Fabian, who plays Howard.
Mm.
Again, someone that I hadn't seen before, but just having a look to see if I'd seen him in anything. I don't think so. I mean, again, he's been in lots of things like Desperate Housewives and Scandal and Elementary, just like an episode here and there, but he's been a consistently working actor. His CSI, he was in Big Love, which I never saw.
You know, again, looking at his late 2000s, mid-late 2000s, everything from, like, CSI Miami, Veronica Mars, Pushing Daisy, Bones, NCIS, Las Vegas, Boston Legal, Burn Notice again. I can't remember him, Burn Notice. The Mentalist, Rizzoli and Isles, CSI New York, Desperate Housewives into the 2010s. You know, he's one of those, yeah, another one of those jobbing actors. Really good, talented character actor. You're like, yep, I can just slot you in there.
Absolutely. I mean, he was in stuff like Beverly Hills 90210. I mean, he had a very, very busy 90s. He was in Star Trek Voyager. He was in Saved by the Bell, The College Years. He was a recurring character in that. He was in a show called Silk Stalkings, which
I believe is currently free on Pluto TV.
Oh, is it? Okay, well, it'd be interesting to go and watch that again, because when I first started working at Sky in the compliance department, one of my jobs at the time was to format that into an ad break version. And so I watched quite a few episodes of Silk Stalkings, which I think only ran for a season or something like that. But
It ran for two seasons on CBS, but then ran for a further six seasons on USA. It ran for eight seasons.
That makes sense, because I was doing it in 99 and he was in it in 92. Yes, okay. It was not good. It was like Basic Instinct, but for telly, which meant that it was a little bit saucy and really trashy. But anyway, but he was in that, so that's the thing. So for 25 odd years...
The note on Wikipedia. Its title is a wordplay on silk stockings. It's like, I would debate that. Is it though? Is it really?
Oh, it is, but it's like, it's not good though.
It's not a good play on words. Like, yeah.
It is wordplay, it's just not a good wordplay. It's like...
My favourite thing about it, apart from Patrick Fabian being involved, is apparently it was narrated by Fred Melamed.
Oh, right, I don't remember that at all.
Which is like, great, Fred Melamed. I mean,
and who's Fred Melamed, for those who don't know?
Fred Melamed he's in A Serious Man. He's one of those actors, like bald, bearded, tremendous presence. Almost like a Wellesian, Orson Wellesian presence. He's in Shiva Baby. He's the dad in Shiva Baby.
He is, that's right.
He's just one of those actors who's like, he's great. He's got such presence and brings such like humour and warmth to anything he's in.
That's right. I do not remember him narrating those. That is absolutely hilarious. But yeah, it just shows that Patrick Fabian was working consistently for 25 years, gets to the mid-2010s, and finds the role of his lifetime, basically, because he is so brilliant as Howard. And again, thinking about Howard, it would have been so easy to make him a villain. He's not a villain. He's such a good guy, I think. I mean, he's brilliant at his job, he's fair. He is a bit of a snob sometimes, but he does the law for the right reasons.
Exactly. He's a bit of a snob. That's kind of it. That's like, you know, he's compassionate. He cares about Jimmy up until a point. And yeah, I mean, his death is... That's the point of no return. That is the Rubicon. That's kind of the point where Jimmy becomes Saul.
Mm.
And I've got the... It's kind of like, you know, my inevitable Shakespeare quote. You know, I'm in blood, stepped in so far that return was tedious as goer. Basically, it's the point of which he can't go back.
And what's that from?
That's from Macbeth.
Yeah.
That's the point where it's like, if he goes back, he has to acknowledge the gravity of what he's been involved in.
Yes.
Whereas if he goes forward, but he just becomes a criminal, he just becomes irredeemable, truly irredeemable. And, you know, when you're truly irredeemable, you don't have to ask yourself difficult moral questions.
That's right, yes. It's not totally irredeemable, because the final episode does do a magic trick in terms of redeeming him, but seemingly irredeemable, because in Breaking Bad, he is purely motivated by self-interest and is utterly self-serving. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, in Breaking Bad, he's obviously a side character, so to give him this full life with his family and a wife and all these different things, and to not have that jar at all with what comes in Breaking Bad, is just so brilliant.
I think this finale is brilliant in terms of how it deals with the past. You know, regret is a recurring theme. It's got, you know, you've got Saul's question first to Mike in that flashback to, I think it's the Bagman episode.
Yeah.
When he's in the desert and he has the time machine thought experiment, and he's got a great line to Mike, "You look like a history buff." And I like that, you know, Mike's first thought is to say, I've written it down, December 8th, 2001, which is presumably the day his son died.
Yes, I was thinking that, yeah.
And then then he says March 17th, 1984, which is the day he took his first bribe because he understands causality.
Yeah.
Jimmy can't pick a point in his life. He proved, like, he initially goes, "I'll go back and Warren Buffett and be a trillionaire." And then talking to Walter later on, he goes, "Well, I'll go back and I'd undo that slipping Jimmy accident that I had." Because Jimmy's somebody who, you know, again, this is why he keeps getting increasingly worse over the course, because he doesn't allow himself to have regrets. Because, you know, as he says to Chuck later on, you know, "You never changed your course."
Mm.
And it's nice, it's really nice seeing those characters in this, in what's presumably going to be, as far as we know, the final installment in the Breaking Bad universe.
Oh, hopefully. We need nothing else.
I mean, yeah, you can't do it. The chance of them pulling it off three times is... But
I would say that they have pulled it off three times, because El Camino, I thought, worked as a epilogue.
That's fair. Actually, that's true.
Because that was just an epilogue to Breaking Bad and, you know, rounded off the Jesse character, and I thought gave him a very, very good story.
I like how you thought they were going to do... Well, obviously they can't, sadly, because he's died. Deus Ex Robert Forster.
Yes, yes, indeed.
When he's in the dumpster, yeah.
Yes, when Jimmy is trying to get in touch with him. But at that point, you think the only way this can go now to be interesting for a final episode is for him to get caught. And then when you hear that cop say, "Anyone home?" And they've all got their guns drawn. But that bit when you have the flashback to him and Walter. Well, two things there. What point is that in Breaking Bad?
I think that's just before Granite State, or even in Granite State, because it's when they get split up and Walter gets moved out to that cabin.
Right.
And they've got that brief time together, and it's the time where Walter basically turns on Saul and says, you know, "We're going to go back and we're going to rebuild and you're going to do this," and fixes him with a steely glare. And then he starts coughing. And then he's completely debilitated by that cough. And then Saul just gives him this look as if, you know, "I'm not afraid of you anymore." And that's the last time you see Saul Goodman, you see Bob Odenkirk in the context of Breaking Bad.
Right. That's a very, very good memory, because I don't actually remember that bit. But and that moment when he says, "I wouldn't do the slipping Jimmy thing because my knees have been playing up," or something like that. Did you take that he would only have not done the slipping Jimmy thing because he still carries the wound of it, and that it's not like with Mike, where Mike realised when he took his first bribe that was the path that led him to this, and he would have had a better life if he hadn't have done that? Did you take it that Jimmy was still thinking, "Well, I still would have grifted, I just wouldn't have done it in that way"?
I don't even think it's a thought of "I still would have." I think he's incapable of thinking of changing that aspect. I think he's not capable of having the thought of, "Oh, maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't." I think he just thought, "Oh," thinks, I'd have changed that one aspect, because he couldn't have the thought about, "Maybe I wouldn't have done it."
Yeah, because Walter says, "Right, so you've always been like this then."
Which is such a great point for with Walt as well, because Walt has always been like that.
Yeah, in what way?
In terms of, like, you know, all his worst qualities. And I think one of the interesting aspects, well, sorry, I keep saying interesting and I keep saying aspect, one of the things about seeing him in the context of Better Call Saul is that you only ever see, for the most part, almost only ever see the worst of Walt. You see him in his most domineering, his most arrogant, his most unlikable. Mm-hmm. You don't get any of the slightly more, you know, redeemable human stuff that you get, at least in the early seasons of Breaking Bad. And, you know, in this, you know, he refuses to entertain that idea of the thought experiment. He lectures Saul on time travel. You know, he's stay in your lane. And there's this tiny little moment where he's drinking water, where he's having a sip of the water, where you kind of see his pain and his weariness, which just, you know, translates into bitchiness. And is, you know, he's incredibly condescending. "You are talking about regrets." And with Walter White, it's fascinating seeing him in Better Call Saul, because then you kind of almost forget that, oh, you had your whole own show. You're the guy who set this up. It's only because your arc worked that we got Better Call Saul.
That's right. If that show hadn't worked, because you're right, because it is one of those things where it's the inverse of Breaking Bad, where you only see Jimmy at his slimiest.
Yes.
In Better Call Saul, you see all of the humanity around him. But with Walt, you only see the demon that he is presented as by the FBI and everyone afterwards, because this thing, as we find out in Better Call Saul, there's like a whole black and white present day thing. Or, you know, after the events of Breaking Bad.
Well, I mean, for the most part, he's just really bitchy.
Yeah, he's cantankerous, he's supercilious, and as you said, just really, really bitchy and snipey.
And because you don't have all of the stuff from Breaking Bad where you're like, okay, well, this is his background, and he's, you know, he's got cancer, and this is where he's at, you just get that. You're essentially seeing a deleted scene from Breaking Bad.
That's the thing, is that they do seem like deleted scenes from Breaking Bad in a way that's not cut because they were redundant, but it's like you can believe they were made at the same time as Breaking Bad. Even though one of the great things about Better Call Saul is that it never went overboard with the de-aging. Like Mike looks noticeably older than he does in Breaking Bad. But you don't care, because it's like, well, Jonathan Banks is so brilliant that no one else could play Mike. So therefore, yeah, that's fine, I don't care. And also the de-aging might not work as well. I mean, and the same with Giancarlo Esposito as Gus. It's like only that character can play that role.
Yeah, I think both of them, they're both quite craggy. And I don't know if it's more difficult to de-age somebody who's quite craggy.
It would look a bit smooth.
It's like, yeah, which crags do we take out?
That's right, it'd just be a bit too smooth.
It's all crags.
But the things that I liked about the two shows is that in Breaking Bad, it was about a guy who came to realise he was the devil. In Better Call Saul, it's about a guy who... It's a guy who...
comes to realise that... Well, yeah, Breaking Bad's about a guy who who realises that he's irredeemable, whereas Better Call Saul's about a guy who realises he might be redeemable.
That's a better way to put it, yeah, because I was thinking there is something malevolent and diabolical about Jimmy as well, particularly when he becomes Saul. Like, with the character of Kim, he is just someone... He doesn't realise he's the devil. He never realises he's the devil. I think that's the point I'm trying to make. Whereas Walt does. But Jimmy is just the great corrupter and the great tempter.
Well, yeah, because you've got him in that... when he makes his entrance into the courtroom for his trial, for his plea, in that shiny suit, and you've got All Things Are Possible by the Harmonising Four playing, and you get the idea that this is church. Mm. This is a sacred place, and that Jimmy is going to go in there and he's going to lie.
He's going to corrupt it. He's going to corrupt the sacred space.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, like, he's one of those things where he literally takes the Constitution in vain because he has the American Constitution as wall art in his office, which is a carryover from Breaking Bad. But, of course, he spends the whole time subverting it, corrupting it, using it for nefarious ends, and basically using the law, which is supposed to bring order and equality. He just uses that as a tool of corruption.
One of my favourite moments in the entire episode is when he uses his one phone call to call Cinnabon.
Yes.
And let them know he's not coming in. You're going to need a new manager. Because, like, it's a bit like Gus. Like, you know, the cover has become the truth. He's living the lie. But on the other hand, it's just like, he's got no reason to do that. That benefits him not at all. But there's some little bit of decency, or some little bit of, like, I don't know, a desire for normalcy. You could just say that. Where he's like, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to let them know. I don't want them to see it in the news. I don't want them to be that the first. That be the first. Like, oh, he's, or I don't want to inconvenience them.
I think that's it. I think the thing with Jimmy is that he is a people pleaser, which you could argue is what motivates him in trying to get the best deal for everyone. Because he goes, I mean, he's the devil, but he works amongst the unfortunates of society, like Jesus did. He goes to the ones that have been rejected, and he tries to make their lives better. He does it in an utterly corrupt way.
When Betsy Brandt talks about Hank, she puts his life in those terms.
Yeah.
In the terms of, like, always wanting to help someone, always wanting to do that. And actually, when you say that about Saul, that kind of sheds a lot of light, because one of the reasons Chuck resented him is, like, you know, Chuck was the A-grade student growing up, he was that, but Jimmy made their mum laugh.
Yeah, that's right.
Because Jimmy was the people pleaser.
Yeah.
Jimmy was the guy who needed people to like him. Like, that was how he was going to ingratiate himself. And whereas Chuck, that kind of calcified into, like, a need for respect. Even if you don't like me, you will respect me.
Mm.
With Jimmy, that turned into, as you say, like, I need to get that guy, I need to get him the best deal, and I need to do that, and I need to do that. With, again, no moral compass.
Yeah. But I think that then ties into and has a consistency with the reason why he then makes his one phone call to Cinnabon. Because it's like, well, I can't leave them in the lurch. I have to let them know what to do today. And there's a few things that need to be picked up and that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, as you know, because we've done it, like, yeah, when you're sick, you call in to say, I'm not coming in, but there's a few things that need to happen so no one gets caught out. So there are no problems in your absence. That was a really, really nice moment. Was there anything else to talk about before we got onto the final episode? I mean, there's so much, of course, but any other favourite moments for you? I mean, yeah, we've not even talked about Michael Mando as Nacho yet, and
oh yeah, Michael
and Tony Dalton as Lalo Salamanca, who's just that's so the thing. Brilliant.
There is, you know, could talk about this, or and Gus's final scene.
Yes, and was that the scene in the hotel bar?
Yeah,
it was, wasn't it? Because I was thinking, was that the last time we saw Gus and had that little character revelation that I don't think we'd had before? Yeah, that was a really, really nice way for Gus to exit.
And yeah, you know, that desire for a human connection,
Yeah, because I don't think that his homosexuality had been brought up in Breaking Bad, had it, unless I'm misremembering.
Well, it's implied because of the death of his partner.
It is.
But you're never sure whether or not, to what extent, that's his partner versus his partner.
Because also, of course, because in Breaking Bad, that is used as a parallel between him and Walter, because Gus wants to have Jesse killed, doesn't he?
Mm.
And Walter's having to talk him out of it and having to protect Jesse. And then you find out that the same thing has happened to Gus. There might have been a suggestion there that I just missed, but I thought that was a really, really nice scene with Gus in the hotel bar when he's flirting with the head barman, whatever it was, over the wine he's got there and things like that. And as you said, he's let his guard down to have that human connection and then realises that all the possibilities of messiness that that could raise are things he can't handle, so therefore he just walks away. And the last time you see him, he's walked away. Really good.
And the fact that the sommelier is played by Reed Diamond.
Who's that?
Reed Diamond, who has actually worked with, I think he's worked with Giancarlo Esposito before, because they're both in Homicide: Life on the Street.
Your beloved Homicide: Life on the Street.
The brilliant Homicide: Life on the Street.
Yeah, dude.
Sorry, I'm trying to trace my thought processes.
I was going to say, while you were thinking of that, I'm just going to say Mark Margolis, Ed Begley Jr., Tina Parker as Francesca. I mean, just the supporting cast. There just isn't a foot wrong in any of this. It's so amazing.
Jimmy, when he's in the prison cell and he's pacing and he's saying, "This is how they get you?"
Mm.
And that reminded me a little bit of that scene in The Wire where you find out how many different ways you can deliver the same thing.
I don't remember that. What's that?
Yeah, it's the fuck scene from The Wire.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're just, you got McNulty and Bunk in the crime scene.
Yeah.
And it's how many different ways you can deliver the word fuck with different intonations that's going to convey different. And you've got Jimmy just repeating the phrase, "This is how they get you."
Yes.
And it ranges from like the incredulous to the despairing to the furious.
See, that's interesting, because that scene in The Wire, when they say it as they are realising what happened and the whole thing is beginning to come together in their head and it's surprising, and then other parts of it are like obvious and that kind of thing. The bit with Jimmy when he was saying, "This is how they get you," and the different ways that he's saying it actually reminded me of the end of The Long Good Friday.
Yeah.
Just the shot of Bob Hoskins when all those different emotions go across his face when he's being driven away by the IRA.
Oh, Rob, everything reminds you of the end of The Long Good Friday. I mean, me too, so.
But it should do, because it's one of the best things in cinema.
You know, Rob, I still remember the evening when you put a bag on my head, drove me out to the desert, and, you know, I found myself in front of an open grave with a gun to my head, and you asked me to do a podcast.
That's it. That was my introduction to Rob Daniel. And look how far we've come.
We're now doing two podcasts.
We are doing two podcasts. This is episode 156 of the Movie Robcast, which is some kind of achievement, right?
Yeah, plus 50-something episodes of Another Time McLeod.
We are over 200 episodes combined of podcasts.
I'm proud to say I was more than a willing participant. I was indispensable.
Yeah, that's right. We haven't made millions from it. That's one thing. But yes, the conversation is its own reward. Well, then millions would be nice. But back to the episode. So, and this has followed on from some brilliant episodes. I mean, the final scene of the previous episode, when the Carol Burnett character just realises who he is, and she finds out really quickly when she says, "Yeah, I googled con man Albuquerque. You were the first thing that came up." And that scene when you think, when he's almost unconsciously wrapping the cord to the computer around his hands, and you think, is he going to do it? Is he going to kill her because he's so boxed in? And then he doesn't, because that isn't who he is. And he has to flee. That, again, that whole scene was just absolutely brilliant.
Like the start of the next episode, the start of this episode, of the final episode of It's All Gone, is a thriller. It's like, you know, it's him on the run. Marion's phoning in, like, you know, to say, well, you know, give the details of the car he's driving, give his license plate. He gets home and he gets the box and the money, and the police are already outside, and he gets out, but there's a helicopter and he has to get undercover, and you get the real sense of the net closing in.
Yeah, that's the thing, and it all collapses really, really quickly, doesn't it? He's been so careful, but when it collapses, it all collapses really quickly. And of course, it all collapses because he insisted on robbing the guy and getting all the credit card information of the guy with cancer. So that's the reason why, I can't remember his name now, but the Pat Healy character who plays the cab driver, that's the reason why he's outside the house. That's the reason why he drives off when the cops are complaining about their takeout, and then he drives off and crashes. If he'd had the decency to not rob someone with cancer, none of that would have happened. But as soon as that happens, everything starts to collapse really, really quickly. Oh, it's just absolutely first class.
Talking about takeout, I love the pan across the table after, you know, where he's there and he's talking with the prosecutor, trying to figure out a deal. And he's been told not 5, not 10, but 27 federal violations. And he's just delivered the case being like, I was afraid for my life. You know, I was kidnapped, put in front of an open grave. And he's not wrong when he says Walt killed a whole bunch of people.
Yep.
And you think jurors are going to buy that? All I need is one.
So good.
And then you've got the pan across the table later on. You've got like all the lawyers looking beaten. There's the Chinese food box with the chopstick sticking out, which is like the universal sign of time passing, of like we've been here a while.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's like there's Chinese takeout, pizzas, there's like sandwiches and that kind of stuff. And there's just a lot of food that's in the process of being eaten. And it's like, it's just such great shorthand for this is a long time later and they have been through everything in forensic detail. And so has he to get the easiest and most lenient sentence.
And that's the thing, that and they're composed front, because they start off by like a prosecuting team and they're like riffing back and forth, and they clearly know this backwards and forwards, and they're like, basically, you know, we're gonna give you 30, you got one time offer, 30 years, and he's beaten them down to 7.5. And also Maria Schrader's wonderful line, they tell me they found you in a garbage dumpster. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, as Hank's widow, who of course she had that brilliant thing as well, which was like that also connects him with Chuck and his mental illness around a fear of electricity. She was a kleptomaniac, wasn't she?
Yeah, the compulsive shoplifting.
Just these little character quirks that could be seen to just put them in there just to give them like something memorable. But from that is built out an entire person, and it's really humane and compassionate. And the way that Hank, who of course is a police officer, is having to deal with this. Just a complete side story to Breaking Bad, but just works so well. It's, oh my God, it's amazing.
They're called minerals, Marie.
There was something else about that scene. That's right, sorry, the scene when they... Yeah, when he gets down to 7.5 years in that real low-security prison, sounds like an open prison, it has a golf program. And he then wants the ice cream, so he gives them one more thing, which is Howard, and how Howard died. And I love where they say, oh, always offering us Howard Hamlin. And there was that laughing, because, of course, Kim Wexler has just completely spilled everything about that to the DA already. They think that they've been able to deny him one thing. What they don't realise is that he now is going to undo everything and is going to basically sacrifice himself and get his soul back because of what this means for Kim.
Yeah, in all fairness, Bluebell mint chocolate chip ice cream is very good ice cream.
Oh, right, I've never had it. Did you have it when you went to America?
Yeah, you can only get it. You can only really get it in the States.
And who's it through?
I think it's just its own thing.
Oh, okay, right. So it's not like a Ben and Jerry's, obviously, because then you'd be able to get it here.
No, I think it's like its own chain.
Well, he says, doesn't he, it's a very good ice cream. Don't they call it artisanal ice cream at some point or something?
Yeah, and mint chocolate chip, which was always my favourite flavour as a child, so, you know.
Oh, that's still my favourite now. You can't get better than mint chocolate chip. It's, oh, love it. Although, what's your favourite now, though?
Actually, you know what? It's still, mint chocolate chip's still probably a pretty strong. I do really like rum and raisin. That's, you know, I got that from my granddad. I also really like how Saul, Jimmy, ends up working in the prison bakery like he was in Cinnabon.
Yeah.
Which, like, if anything, is like probably psychologically more healthy, because at least he's in a structured environment where he's getting some degree of respect.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because they all know who he is when all the convicts in the bus that's driving them to prison all know who he is and start to chant, Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul.
That scene was amazing when it was like, all right, maybe I will be somebody here. And it's just one of those things where it's like, almost if you, not good, if you don't put good out into the world, but if you put yourself out into the world and can seem to be useful, that will come back to you in the oddest kind of situation. But then that bit when that guy, when he has to go and see his lawyer, who of course is Kim, so Jimmy leaves the kitchen and that other guy, the other convict, says, I've got you, Jimmy, and they do a fist bump. And it's like, yeah, you do get the impression that he's actually been able to integrate quite well into the prison system with his, what is it, 86 years, did he get something like that?
Yeah, and he has the joke later on, you know, with good behaviour.
Yeah,
it's a really nice, because it's a repeat, his final scene with Kim, with them sharing a cigarette, which is very much like in the pilot in Uno.
Yeah, so good.
And in the black and white scene, in the back, you know, all the present day stuff being set in black and white, the tip of the cigarette glowing.
Yeah.
Is just such a nice touch.
And why do you think they did that?
I think in the present day stuff with the black and white or the grey, my initial impression when they did it in the first season is that this is a man who's in stasis. All the colour is out of his, is drained out of his world. He's lost something.
Mm.
And sharing that cigarette with Kim, he's got that thing back. And I don't know whether like you can be cheesy and say it's hope. And he's already quote unquote as redeemed as he's going to be. He's told the truth, even at great personal cost. But that's the moment where he's like, he regains the thing that, because Kim talks about her New Mexico bar card, which, you know, I think when she leaves and he has the finger guns at her, which again, I think is another repeat of a thing he's done previously.
Yeah.
I guess it's a little bit ambiguous as to whether she's ever coming back, but the fact that she's mentioned the New Mexico bar card suggests she might be.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, I took it as that she has brought some colour back into his life.
Mm.
And you're right, all the black and white stuff, it is shot as if he's in stasis. I mean, it looked gorgeous, but it's like there is no life to this in a way. But when you have colour, you have that little bit of life in there. But what is the colour? It is literally a burning ember. It's like there is a certain connotation with retribution and punishment that comes from a lit cigarette and, like, yeah, from burning, basically.
Apparently they considered having Kim return the finger guns on her way out, but they thought that that might suggest that she's going to go back to her old larcenous ways.
Yeah.
I like how she's now at the mid-ground because she's not blonde Kim and she's not the black hair with the bangs, the kind of, you know, housewife, like, incredibly mundane conversations about Red Lobster and...
And the corduroy skirts.
Yeah, exactly. She's now black hair but no bangs.
Yeah, and it's one of those things as well where I think to give the finger guns would have... Well, it would have been cheesy, I think, but I think it's also one of those things where it's like, no, it's much better for her to just give a sad smile because the finger guns, as you've said, like, yeah, there is a road that you go down to be a lawyer who gives finger guns and she's not there anymore. And she doesn't even have the stopper to that incredibly expensive brandy, was it, that they drank when they were...
Oh, the something Anejo brandy.
Yeah, when they were scamming that guy, and... Because you see the stopper, don't you? I think in the first episode of this season, when it's just...
It's not brandy, it's tequila.
Tequila, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
And you see it in the first episode, I think, of this season, when they're clearing out his mansion.
Zafiro Anejo.
And how much did it go for?
It's fictional.
Oh, is it? Oh, right. Oh, I thought it was like a real thing. There we go. Oh, they're just... It's all just so convincing.
And, yeah, I also just love the line in this episode that when Jimmy is talking to Chuck about the calibre of his clients, waving his weenie outside a Hobby Lobby, which might well be the title of my autobiography.
I also like the way that Chuck still did have these little impacts on Jimmy and these little kind of influences. The fact that he's reading the Time Machine was just such a nice touch. And even though Jimmy in that scene seemed to be really, really dismissive, there were still things that Chuck did that would stick with him. Well, to finish off, is there anything else from that scene in the court when Jimmy gets his soul back that you want to talk about?
I do like the, you know, when he's talking to Bill. Poor Bill, his co-counsel.
Bill was great.
Bill Oakley, who, you know, was formerly a prosecutor, became a defence counsel, and you've got him up and he drops his folder when he's up on the rooftop car park and when he hears Saul's voice.
Yes.
And you just know that he's going to get screwed. You don't know how, but you just know that he's not going to come out on top.
Yes, played by Peter DeSeth. He just has that weary look on his face. Yeah, because he's the kind of lawyer I think I would be. He's not the best lawyer, but he's a competent enough lawyer that he will always kind of get work. But he's not the kind of person that is going to give you the flashiest defense. But he'll try hard. But when he hears Jimmy's voice, he knows he's going to get fucked over. He just doesn't quite have either the canniness or the intelligence to work out how it's going to happen, but he knows it's going to happen.
There's just a slight touch of, like, I don't know, either Gil from The Simpsons or Ted from Scrubs.
Oh, I never watched Scrubs.
Oh, Ted from Scrubs is the lawyer from Scrubs, who was played by Sam Lloyd, who I think died a couple of years ago. That great actor, like, classic, absolute sad sack, for whom absolutely nothing goes right.
Well, Bill is, yeah, he is a sad sack. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, we also need to give a shout out to Peter Gould, who is the co-creator along with Vince Gilligan.
Of course. Yeah, who actually I think ended up being sole showrunner.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think Vince Gilligan, I know he directed an episode, I think actually he wrote and directed the final episode, if I remember correctly. At least, let me double check this. Oh, no, Peter Gould wrote and directed the final episode, and Vince Gilligan wasn't involved. Vince Gilligan was definitely involved in the final season.
Right, okay.
Vince Gilligan wrote and directed Waterworks, which was the penultimate episode.
Right, okay.
This was Peter Gould. Yeah, and when he's talking to Bill in the courtroom, and Bill tries to keeps trying to cut him off, you know, saying that this is speculation, you don't know what have happened. And he's, Bill, please just let me get through this.
And that's the thing, when everything that Bill is saying is also very, very good dialogue, but you don't hear it because everyone is kind of shouting over him. But again, it just shows, well, they are writing really good dialogue for the stuff that you don't hear, or for the stuff that is kind of mixed low in the mix, because it's not as important, but it's very important that he be saying plausible stuff.
Also, that thing with your brother wasn't even a crime. It was. And then he says the name's McGill, James McGill, and that's kind of him reclaiming his humanity.
Because when he walks in and he's got that suit, it's probably not a shark skin suit, but it looks like it might as well be, and it's just so flashy.
It's so gold, it's so shiny.
It's showtime. But the way that he just, word for word, repeats the spiel about his introduction to Walter White, and you think it's going to go down the same road as him playing the victim card, the reluctant lawyer, and then he twists it. And even though it's obvious what's going to happen, that still surprised me in the moment. So I was with, what's her name again? Hank's widow? Marie.
Oh, Marie. Played by the wonderful Betsy Brandt.
Indeed. Yes, I was with Marie on that when she looks up really suddenly. And yeah. Oh my God, there were just so many great moments in that scene. And the fact, yeah, that he had said he would testify, or that he would bring something incriminating against Kim because he knew that was the only way that
something that will make their toes curl.
Yes, and he knew that was the only way that he could get her to be there. But the thing that makes her toes curl, I suppose, is him confessing everything. That moment when he confesses everything and he talks about why he did it reminded me of the moment in The Shield, and I think is it the final episode of The Shield?
When Vic Mackey lays it out.
And just says everything.
And we're back on Walton Goggins.
That's right, yes. Michael Chiklis, right, plays Vic Mackey.
Yeah.
That's an amazing moment in that show as well, because I think when he's thinking about what he's going to say, something like 45 or 50 seconds of silence is just him thinking about it. And
I love that they told him that he needs to make a full account, because anything that he leaves out, he's still open to prosecution for. And they don't know the extent of the shit that he's done. So when he starts going through, and because it starts with the murder of the mole played by Reed Diamond in the pilot.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that brings it all back, doesn't it? That is amazing.
Because that's partly why the death of Reed Diamond's meant to be shocking, because people know him from Homicide.
Ah, that's... yeah, I didn't actually get that, because I never watched Homicide. But that was still shocking, because you think that's going to be the story for the first season of The Shield, is that there's a mole and you're going to try and get Vic, and Vic's going to have to outsmart him. But Vic doesn't even know about it yet. And then at the end of the first episode, they kill the mole, who is a policeman. And it's like, well, didn't expect that. Okay, you've got me for episode two. And then... yeah, The Shield was just, oh my God, it was just so amazing as well. But yeah, that scene when Vic is just getting it all straight in his head and then just spills it all out, and none of them know how bad it's going to be, and just the shock on their faces when he's talking about all the murders and all the corruption and the violence and enabling drug dealers and all that kind of stuff. It's just, oh, it's such a brilliant show, The Shield was. But off the back of this, it's like, well, I might have to go and watch Breaking Bad again.
Yeah, I really want to. It's just about finding the time.
It is, isn't it?
It's not going to be a background watch.
No, can't be. And it is like, well, I know how long it takes. It takes a month. I watched pretty much nothing else apart from Breaking Bad for a month and just worked through the whole thing. Sometimes realizing that I'd moved on to the new season, like that episode where Jesse has to get to the new cook to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Who is he? Because he's...
Gail. When he has to kill Gail.
Yes, and what's his name? What's the actor's name? Because he's in Billions, isn't he? I can't think of his name right now.
David Costabile.
Yes. When I was watching at the beginning of the next episode, I realised, oh my God, that was the season finale. People had to wait a year to see what happened next. And now I could just go on to the next episode. And it was a great way to watch it, as was great to watch the first five seasons of Better Call Saul in one go. But it has been nice watching it week to week, and then having that break, and the break being when Howard gets killed, and then you have the, I don't know, month break, whatever it was, and none of the episodes, I think, drop below 5 stars, which is incredible, right? You get to the end of the episode and think, that was another brilliant hour of TV I've watched, and there was nothing I'd change about that, nothing I've got to complain about.
I'm gonna be a little bit, possibly tediously didactic here, and say that, you know, remember in Breaking Bad, where in the pilot episode... Walter White describes chemistry as the study of change, which is kind of the thesis for the show.
Yeah.
I've just Googled law is the study of, and the first result is from the London School of Economics, which says, law is the endeavour of human beings to govern our personal, social, economic and political relationships through the use of rules. To study law is to study the nature of those relationships. Which actually covers quite a lot of Better Call Saul.
Yeah, absolutely it does, doesn't it? Yeah, so anything else to say about this wonderful final episode, Saul gone, of this incredible series?
No, other than to say that, yeah, I need to rewatch all of Breaking Bad now, if only so I can get to Felina.
What's that one?
Felina is the final episode of Breaking Bad.
Oh, okay, right. That's kind of implied I need to watch all of Breaking Bad now. Although I actually think that the best episode of towards the end of Breaking Bad is Ozymandias, which is the one with Hank in the desert, where Hank and
yeah, Hank and Gomez die.
Yeah, but the final episode is also lovely. And I mean, that bit with the M60 in the back of his car, which again is like a big action scene, but it's completely believable in the scope of the character and his ability. Yes, so thank you, Better Call Saul. And I think it's a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah. Well, Rob, thank you very much for an impromptu, really enjoyable discussion of Better Call Saul, the finale of Better Call Saul, a show that up until this point we had never discussed on the podcast.
Absolutely. We kind of... Sorry, you had suggested it could be quite nice to do an episode about it after the final episode. I was like, yeah. And we haven't really done that. But yeah, that sounds like it might be quite nice. And then on Tuesday, just gone, because we're recording this on Thursday, the 18th of August... I was about half hour having watched the final episode when you popped through a WhatsApp saying, we really need to talk about that final episode on the pod. And it's like, yeah. Yeah, we do, don't we? We need to do a Better Call Saul episode.
Yes.
Yeah, so thank you for having the idea. It was a fine idea.
So yeah, well, Rob, if listeners are looking for you online, where can they find you?
Well, if you want to hire my services as a defence lawyer, then... Yeah, luck, I'm not. But if you want to read my musings on Twitter, then I am at @Rob_A_Daniel. You can find my writing at electric-shadows.com. There's also some stuff on filmstories.co.uk and lovehorror.co.uk. Rob and I also do a Highlander-themed podcast, as we would have mentioned, I think, at the top of this show. So we go through that wonderful film Highlander scene by scene, and... Yeah, we're kind of rapidly approaching the end of the film now on that. So there's a lot of Highlander waiting for you. That's called Another Time McLeod. You can listen to it wherever you listen to this podcast. You can follow that on Twitter at McLeod Time. And if you want to send us a Highlander-themed email, then you can at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Great. And yeah, if you're looking for me online, you can find me on Twitter at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. I will send a link to my former site, ofallthefilmblogs.blogspot.com, to Mr. Daniel. So you can hopefully, if you're interested, find the links to my now really approaching a decade-old reviews of Breaking Bad. Blimey. and yes, if you're looking for this podcast online, you can find it at Movie Robcast. And Mr. Daniel, I believe we also now have an email.
We do, yes. If you want to drop us a line about what we discuss in the episodes or just film in general, then yeah, you can. You can do that at movierobcast@gmail.com.
Excellent. And if you've enjoyed this, please do rate and review on the podcatcher of your choice. It's great to have the feedback, and it really does make a difference in terms of engagement. Well, thank you again, Mr. Daniel.
No, thank you very much.
And thank you very much for listening. And we'll be with you again very soon. Showtime.